Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Hughes. I'm president of the Missouri Foundation for Health and a proud member of Grantmakers in Health board. It's my pleasure to welcome you to today's Terrence Keenan Award presentation. This afternoon, we'll be recognizing Chet Hewitt, president and CEO of Sierra Health Foundation, who will receive the 2017 Terrence Keenan Leadership Award. This award honors outstanding individuals in the field of philanthropy whose work is distinguished by leadership, innovation, and achievement. First awarded in 1993, the Leadership Award reflects Terry Keenan's unique contributions over four decades in health philanthropy. It's a privilege to introduce Chet Hewitt and tell you a little bit about him. It's especially nice to do that with his family here, with members of the Board of Trustees from the Sierra Health Foundation and members of the staff of the Sierra Health Foundation. It's great that you all are here and well-deserving for Chet. You know, Chet, before becoming president and CEO of the Sierra Health Foundation, was director of Alameda County's Social Service Agency, a large organization, 2,400 employees, $600 million annual budget. And his arrival at both the Sierra Health Foundation and in Alameda County were similar. Things were, to put it mildly, challenging. At Alameda County, his department was declared the poorest performer in California and was threatened with state takeover. Chet arrived just as the Great Recession was really decimating the endowment at Sierra Health Foundation. So what does it take to assume leadership of an organization facing big challenges and transform it to new levels of performance and effectiveness? Remarkably, Chet accomplished that at both organizations. He led a wide-ranging departmental overhaul and turnaround at the Alameda County Agency, including a fundamental rethinking and reshaping of an entrenched system of care for over 5,000 foster children. And at Sierra Health Foundation, he led the organization in the counterintuitive step of investing more in the face of declining assets, transforming Sierra Health into a leader in innovative practices that leveraged outside resources to improve systems ranging from juvenile justice to child protective services. Both organizational transformations were triumphs in systemic social change. Peers in more than 30 states have adopted the model that Chet established in Alameda County, and the Sierra Health Foundation case study has been published as an example of effectively tackling the underlying determinants of health. Chet's personal qualities are crucial to his effectiveness. He is forthright, persistent, he lives his values, and he believes in changing systems to make people's lives better. He takes things head on, respects the people he works with, and he trusts them to move things forward. And yet, despite all he's done, he is unassuming about himself and others. As one of Chet's colleagues noted, he doesn't take for granted who he is or what your story might be. And that's a very powerful thing about Chet. Others have not always reciprocated and been as open and respectful to Chet. For example, when he came to the Alameda County job, some assumed that his previous position as an assistant director at the Rockefeller Foundation meant he came from an elite East Coast background with little experience that would be relevant to the lives of people served by the agency he led. East Coast, yes. Elite, no. Chet grew up in a poor area of New York City, and at 16, found himself in jail for a seven-month stint at Rikers Island. Yet he found a pathway that included getting his high school equivalency, completing law school without having attended college, and parenting a dozen foster children. Remarkable. For the last decade, that pathway has been at Sierra Health Foundation, where Chet has, in the words of his nomination letter, transformed the Sacramento region's largest philanthropic organization into a catalyst for mission-driven change. Chet's innovative and creative leadership is driven by his openness and honesty, coupled with a clear sense of justice and purpose. It's a distinct honor and pleasure to introduce Chet Hewitt and present him with the 2017 Terrence Keenan Leadership Award. Chet.
Let me start by thanking Bob for his warm introduction and thanking all of you for being here this afternoon. The honor of being selected to receive the 2017 Terrence Keenan Award is indeed a highlight in my career in health philanthropy. I am humbled by the award's purpose, what it represents to the world of philanthropy, and the impressive list of individuals who make up its alumni. I've gotten to work with a number of them, and I can attest that they are all creative and compassionate leaders who are deserving of such an award. I must also say that the fact that I will now be included among them is, in the words of my older son, just pretty awesome. And although I have never met Terrence Keenan, I have been aware of his reputation and influence on our branch of philanthropy for some time. Most recently, I reread Jim Kimmy's remarks from 2013, the year he received the TK Award. And I was struck by the way he described Terrence's impact on his career, although they too had never met. Using Terrence's own words, Jim reminded us that great foundations are animated by a moral purpose. Walk humbly with their grantee partners, take risks and act even in the face of great odds, are a resource for discovery and change, build and join partnerships, and engage in self-renewing and reflective practice. These words were thoughtful reflections of a standard bearer's career when they were first written in 1992. They were sage advice for a field emerging from the Great Recession in 2013, when Jim reminded us of those words. And I believe they now serve as a powerful call to action for the challenges health philanthropy will face in 2017 and beyond. In my remarks this afternoon, I'd like to accomplish two things. First, I want to speak to what for me have been two of Terrence Keenan's most relevant maxims captured in the paper that he wrote in 1992. It was entitled The Promise at Hand. Then I'd like to offer some personal insight on how they've impacted the way in which we've approached our work at the Sierra Health Foundation. And then I would like to close by thanking some folks whose support was, is, and remains essential to the reason that I stand before you this afternoon, and from whom I draw inspiration to continue to do meaningful work in the future. So let me begin. My two favorite, what I'll describe as Keenanisms, right? The first is great foundations are informed and animated by moral purpose. And the second being great foundations take risk and proceed in the face of great odds. These maxims strike me as important guides, not just for health philanthropy, but for all philanthropy. And for reasons too numerous to mention here in this room today, they just seem especially relevant. So a great foundation is animated and informed by moral purpose. By many objective measures, the health of poor communities and individuals across our nation are under assault. We are facing fundamental shifts in fiscal and regulatory policy that is unapologetic in their refusal to take into account evidence of what needs to be done to improve the overall health of our nation. Moreover, they seem to care little about what needs to be done to take specific steps to reduce disparities in health that disproportionately affect Americans who are poor, of color, and too often, both. As you are very likely aware, the recent budget proposal released by the federal government threatens to roll back many of the most significant and effective social and health policy gains made over the past five decades. Shockingly, a report from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities described the proposed budget as both poorly prepared and essentially working to turn back the clock to decades well before the 1960s. This is achieved by reducing spending in key areas that have direct and indirect health implications. These include Medicaid, education, transportation, job training, low-income housing assistance, Head Start, child care, and SNAP, a program established after researchers found child and adult-related nutrition-based diseases at levels in America that look similar to the developing world. Now, we know from credible evidence how important these social programs have been to our ability to make measurable improvements in healthcare access, overall health status, and advances toward health equity. Building upon the impact and knowledge they generated, we now better understand the effects of poverty on health, the lack of access to affordable and healthy food has on diet, how persistent and severe stress affects physical health, that transportation can facilitate work, which can facilitate health, and how inequitable land use and planning can make the pursuit of healthy habits more challenging than they would normally be. We know when these public investments are managed well, with transparency, inclusivity, and with an eye toward equity, they contribute powerfully to the nation's health and especially to the health of the poor. Just as we as a field were positioning ourselves to take significant next steps into the next phase of health philanthropy, moving from figuring out what we need to know about the effects of poverty, race, and place on health, to doing what needs to be done to eliminate their negative effects, the policy train seems to have lost its wheels. In so many ways, we had reached a precipice that promised a very exciting and progressive time for those of us who share a vision of health equity, and suddenly has become a much more concerning era. In addition to being challenged to meet the moral imperative of responding to our new understanding of health and healthcare delivery and the social determinants of health, we now have the added responsibility of actively working to protect public investments upon which we had hoped to build these new models. We were inspired when our colleagues at RWJ encouraged us to build a culture of health. I think what we've learned is that we now need to build a social movement for health, to walk beside and protect those powerful ideas. As a modest-sized foundation, actually we're a small foundation, Sierra Health has been positioning itself to engage in this work for some time, not because we could see the future, but because we landed here as a result of our listening to community leaders who asked us not to show up to save them, but to help them learn how to promote policy and systemic changes so they can help themselves. 5 years ago, we began this journey as we charted our own post-recession course. So what did this look like for us? At the institutional level, we made a commitment to being better able to understand and connect with communities disproportionately impacted by chronic illness and populations living in physical environments that contributed to their prevalence. We also made a commitment to fund nascent community groups led by and serving people of color that had authentic connection to community. We would treat these groups as full partners, not grantees. We said, if you want a grant, there's a lot of place to go. If you're looking for a partner, you can come and talk to us. We'd be respectful to and invest in their leadership and in their perspectives. We committed to developing internal processes that were less burdensome and transactional, and to focus our time on implementing practices that support our ability to deepen and establish relationships. We committed to looking beyond the limitations of our community partners, who we believe to be essential to a constituent-driven health movement by focusing less on their present limitations and more on their future potential. We committed ourselves to diversifying our staff, the hiring program officers who reflect the populations living in the places we would work. And despite losses suffered during the great downturn that we know would not return from a rebounding market, we expanded our grant-making area to include California's San Joaquin Valley, with a confluence of the same public investments now under attack: affordable housing, transportation, early childhood education, food insecurity, environmental hazards, and many others have had an extraordinary and negative impact on the health of communities and individuals, and ultimately, overall state of health in our great state. Now, despite the scale and prospective cost of this challenge, and I'm not just talking about financial costs, we felt a moral imperative to take it on. So what does a moral imperative look like? Let me provide a visual. If I were to show you a political map of California based on population voting patterns, it would be, as most of you would expect in this room, predominantly blue, particularly along our high population coastline, with swaths of red in its less populated central, northern, and eastern regions. But as you can see, if you use a health map, California is actually a green and yellow state with considerable amount of hotspot orange concentrated at its center. What you see here is a map of California called Cal EnviroScreen. It was developed by a branch of Cal EPA to portray a broad picture of the relative burdens in California communities from pollution. The map presents 20 indicators of environmental conditions and population vulnerability at the census tract level. You can view them individually or as an index across four domains: exposures, environmental effects, sensitive populations, including poor health, and socioeconomic factors, education, and poverty. The overlay of the four domains that you see here presents a powerful and compelling image of where poverty, disease exposure, and the impact of poor environmental conditions coalesce to produce disproportionate levels of poor health in our state. The region has some of the highest rates of diabetes, asthma, and food insecurity. It also has one in four schools where you can't drink the water. Now, this region is best known to most of you as the food basket of America. But look beyond this headline, and you would be told that it's also referred to as the Appalachia of the West. Now, we knew at the outset, as Mark Smith cautioned us in his 2014 TK remarks, that one institution alone, one field alone, doesn't have the resources and relationships to influence policy and systems change at a scale necessary to change outcomes in the Valley, particularly if we were doing it by ourselves. In fact, no single organization can do so. So we founded an intermediary. It's called the Center at Sierra Health, a public charity with an H designation so we could lobby, to manage investments made by funding partners to both improve service delivery and to establish social impact networks, a social movement for health. The center is focused on bringing together people, ideas, and resources to address health disparities in California's most impacted communities and populations. The San Joaquin Valley Health Fund is the largest fund we've launched to date, supported by 9 forward-thinking funders: California Endowment, California Wellness Foundation, the Rosenberg Foundation, Dignity Health, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the Coulter Foundation, Tides, and the Blue Shield of California Foundation, and an anonymous donor who found us from Boston. Not sure how that happened. But we have also adopted this approach for juvenile justice reform, for our work in African-American child mortality, and for our 19-member coalition to address the conditions facing boys and men of color in California. The idea is simple, but as we expected, its execution was complicated. Most importantly, the results have been worth it. The image you see here is the rising of a movement for health, a health for all mentality, to borrow a term from our colleagues at the California Endowment, that is taking place across California, including the Valley. So on February 9th of this year, 1,000 residents from the Valley showed up at the Capitol Mall. This is where our legislature meets in California. And they made a demand that the legislators pay much more attention to the conditions in their communities. With a multiple strategy policy proposal in hand and a recent report on the status of children in the Valley, they spoke directly to the legislators from both sides of the aisle, who felt that perhaps it was time to pay more attention to their conditions. The funny thing happens when you show up at the legislature with 1,000 people. You know, people tend to want to hear what you have to say. You know, I would say that the storyline here has been pretty straightforward. It's about building a movement. But it's been animated by an undeniable moral imperative. It's been informed by knowledge and irrefutable evidence. And it is being pushed over the top by citizens who are clamoring to find their own agency, who want to work hard to produce better conditions for their children and for their families. We do a lot of great things in philanthropy, but one of the things that we have to do better is to make sure those that we say we work for and those that we work with have an even more important and powerful presence in the conversations that we're having. I think if we learned everything over the last 6 months is that not paying attention to the folks who are being left behind comes at great risk and hasn't put us in a better place. The moral underpinnings of our approach and our willingness to embrace our moral calling, I think, is beautifully captured in a paper entitled Introduction to Social Justice that was written by Jesuit priest Father William Ferrer in 1948. In it, he reminds us that we have a moral duty to continually reorganize society for the common good as a consequence of our growing understanding of the concept of social responsibility as opposed to individual responsibility. And now knowing this, we all have a responsibility to work towards solving the disparities and injustices that exist in the world. I believe it is in this narrative space that great philanthropy is and will be practiced in the future. I referenced at the beginning of my remarks my second Keynesianism, which is a great foundation, takes risks, and proceeds in the face of great odds. And I'll tell you, I can't think of a time in my career in which this was a more important concept to embrace than it is now. As policy changes are presented that place vulnerable communities and populations at even greater risk in the regions in which we operate, we at the Sierra Health Foundation decided to care more about what we can do now to resist these shifts and how long we may be here to respond to the challenges we know they're going to exacerbate. We call it a kind of health harm prevention. Now, we know well the risks and odds this creates to respect to our future, and understand that making this decision may well be the most courageous call we've made yet. Our belief is that by not doing all we can to push back against the pending ravages of bad policy built on false evidence now, we put at risk the full value of our past investments and assign those we'll make in the future to the role of remediation for a generation to come. As Health Philanthropy considers how to respond to our new reality, I suggest that regardless of the approach you take, we need to act and proceed with the sense of urgency and determination necessary to prevail. And whatever level of activity you are prepared to take, I suggest a backup plan that enables you to do more. We are not living in a time for relative complacency. I know it's difficult to associate the word complacent with some of the finest philanthropic organizations in the world. And I know we mobilize and leverage millions, billions even, to support ideas, institutions, and people in places that are committed to our cause. And that certainly can't be classified as doing nothing. But at the same time, given the privileged space we occupy, the typical meaning of the word complacency does not adequately apply. In a book I've recently read entitled The Complacent Class, the author's assessment is that despite all we're doing in celebrating signs of our commitment to a more just and equitable society, we are not making the progress you would expect. He supports his position by comparing the level of social progress made in the 60s and 70s to what's been made over the past two decades. He argues that institutions and individuals are complacent in ways that seem to be a bit overstated to me. But he does raise an important point. I'd argue that complacency should not be defined by the degree to which we think we are doing a lot because we are. The question is, are we doing enough to be successful? I'm not as pessimistic about the future as the author seems to be, but I do believe there is much more we could do to lift the voices of those closest to the places and populations who are being left out and left behind. I dread to think about the cost in lives and health that we as a society will pay if we continue to move in our current direction. At the same time, I'm heartened by Health Philanthropy's response. We are thinking beyond political personalities, which is damn hard to do these days, and focusing more on the moral imperative and assuming the odds and risks we need to overcome the challenges we are facing. A growing number of health foundations and other foundations are investing more, leveraging their influence more, supporting more advocacy, and investing in the building of movement in response to what may be, in fact, the most important moral and ethical calling of our time. I've said a lot and I haven't been booed, so while the going is good, let me close by saying thanks to three groups of people. Members in this first group can't each be shouted out by name because there are just simply too many of you. And honestly, some of the names I don't recall. But by category, you are mentors, colleagues, nonprofit partners, elected officials, focus group participants, community residents, and the occasional conference attendee who said something brilliant, but who I never seen again. Of course, this group does include two people who I will call out. One is the incredible Faith Mitchell, who leads up GIH. And my good friend Anthony Chang, who thought enough of my work to nominate me for this honor. Thank you, Anthony. Truly my brother. I have truly learned so much from each and every one of you, and I will forever be in your debt. My second round of thanks goes to my Sierra Health Foundation family. As they know, I'm very fond of saying that no one does anything extraordinary by themselves. And this notion is on full display here today. To the executive team I've had the pleasure of working with for over the past decade, Diane Littlefield and Gil Alvarado, and to the rest of the foundation's extraordinary, extraordinary staff, I want to thank you for bringing your passion and commitment to the work that we've undertaken. And to my Sierra Health Foundation board, who has deliberated, debated, and wondered, you know, how this would all turn out, please know that your guidance and willingness to look toward the future, while never forgetting the lessons of the past, is an invaluable part of our collective success. And then finally, I want to close by thanking my family. My beautiful wife, Laura, I love you without limit, whose own health journey has taught us a lot. Last year, this time, my wife was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And I would tell you, we talk and think like we know a lot about healthcare. But I'll tell you, until you walk through that journey, until you see what systems do and don't do, even for someone who is known in his community as a leader of a health foundation, it's pretty shocking. If we didn't have a community of folks who loved and cared about us, if we didn't have transportation and a job, if we didn't have work and folks who delivered meals to our doorsteps, on days when my job was to take care of my sons, I don't know how you make it through that journey by yourself. So when we think about the assault that I mentioned, an attempt to eviscerate the things we all need to be whole, the things we all need to be healthy, don't take the conversation lightly. Don't be complacent in your response. Don't think you can't be prepared to do more. And don't think because you're doing a lot now, it'll be sufficient for us to be successful. Because in many ways, I have all those qualities in my own little part of the world. Without a willingness to be on-scene advocate at all times, I'm not exactly sure what the experience would have been. The upside of this story is that my wife is here with us today, and she is healthy. And no matter where you go in this life, you're always learning, because I have learned more about strength and determination, about values, and about the power of one's faith over the past year than I've experienced over the past decade. And so, Laura, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And then, you know, and then lastly, I want to thank my two sons, Chet the second. I say Chet the improved version. That is the plan of all parents, right? And Stephen Miles. Every household needs a wild man, then we definitely got ours. Right? Who have grown up coming to this conferences. And for many of you who have known me when I served on the board, I think Chet was about 4 when we started, and he's 12 now and as tall as I am, and doing some great things. And Stefan, who we pushed through the St. Louis Jew in a stroller when we met in St. Louis many years ago, who is now on his way to the 5th grade. I want to thank them because they never fail to remind me, just by simply being, that what I want for them is what we should all want for all children. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.